It's almost surreal. It's something that for 50 years we've all anxiously awaited, worked on, prayed about, and now to be a reality for all of us.
Mississippi's Attorney General reflects on the massive win for life at the Supreme Court. She and her handpicked Solicitor General, who argued the case before the justices, join us on the record.
I'm actually ecstatic to hear that. I know there's a lot of work still to be done in the individual states, but I'm really excited.
Reaction from everyday women to the High Court's abortion ruling. And acknowledging that much needs to be done in support of families, we talked to two leading family advocates.
Are you prepared to take the oath?
I am.
The makeup of the Supreme Court changes. As one liberal justice retires, another takes his place. And the Pope takes an active role this week in the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul, presiding over the opening Mass. In his homily, he calls on Catholics to care for the vulnerable. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
I feel empowered by this decision. I feel like my rights have been fought for, and I feel excited to continue this fight.
Revolutionary change in America for women, children, families, and the unborn, as the Supreme Court overturns the case that legalized abortion across the nation. And a new face arrives at the High Court as Ketanji Brown Jackson, America's first black female justice, takes her place on the bench. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. One of the most consequential terms in U.S. Supreme Court history has ended, with the last decisions announced just this week. As recently appointed justices find their footing, majority rulings caused a tsunami of societal changes, reversing long-standing precedent on guns, the environment, and matters of religious liberty. And the long-awaited case for the pro-life movement, of course, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. The Mississippi case involved the state's only abortion clinic, which sued the state when the legislature passed a law restricting most abortions after 15 weeks, saying the legislation violated the Supreme Court precedent in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Much unchanged from the draft opinion leaked in February, Justice Samuel Alito authored the 6-3 majority opinion, writing, "The Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey are overruled, and the authority to regulate abortion is returned to the people and their elected representatives." In a searing dissent, Supreme Court Justices Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan said the choice of whether to bear a child is essential for women to control their own bodies and the course of their lives. In returning abortion legislation to elected representatives in the states, legislatures are no longer blocked from restricting, regulating, or prohibiting abortion, nor are they stopped from passing more permissive abortion laws. More than a week after the decision, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle continue to press their positions.
What this means to women is such an insult. It's a slap in the face to women about using their own judgment to make their own decisions about their reproductive freedom.
This is certainly a day that pro-lifers have been waiting for 49 years. Today's Supreme Court decision was a step to protect the most precious and basic right, the right to life. Roe versus Wade was unconstitutional. The pro-life community has always known this. Every innocent life is precious, from conception until natural death. But for nearly five decades, abortion has remained one of the biggest tragedies of our nation.
But what are the thoughts of everyday women on the street? EWTN News In Depth captured some first impressions when the decision was announced last week. Here's reporter Mark Irons.
We will abolish abortion!
1 week removed from a historic victory for unborn life, and varied reaction continues around the country.
I'm really pro-life. All these women don't get that choice anymore.
The reversal of Roe versus Wade is on people's minds, from outside the Supreme Court.
Women's rights are paramount.
To outside church.
The news about Roe v. Wade being overturned came down. What's your reaction?
I'm actually ecstatic to hear that.
Across the U.S., opposition to the Supreme Court's decision heated and at times violent. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the capital of a political battleground state with important elections coming up and voters divided over abortion, we spoke with women hours after the overturning of Roe.
I praise the Lord for this overturning. He's turning, I believe, overturning a lot of the wrong in our land, and this is just a huge beginning.
In her early 20s, Mary Blue had two abortions. She regrets her decisions, but leans on her Christian faith. She says women who've had abortions can find the same healing she has.
You have to start where you're at and know that God's grace is sufficient. He's a God of healing.
It's a war against women.
Across the street, young adults Molly Crowell and Sophie Palmer were on their way to protest the Supreme Court's ruling outside the state Capitol building. Both women grew up educated in Catholic high school, but reject the church's teaching that life begins at conception.
It was more of pushing this on you as this is how it has to be, and we weren't allowed to have our own opinions. If you force a woman to carry a baby to term that she maybe can't care for, then that's kind of an impossible situation.
The church really needs to mobilize.
Post-Roe, pro-life Catholics say it will be essential to give even greater care and resources to pregnant women who feel they won't be able to care for their child.
All the things that make women afraid and run towards abortion. We want to help women get away from abortion.
Dominique Serafin is the director of evangelization for a Catholic church in Germantown, Maryland. It's a state, like many others, where abortion law won't change even with the reversal of Roe. But Serafin sees this historic moment in time as a great opportunity.
To pray for women in crisis pregnancy, to pray for women who are angry right now, I do not think it's a time to gloat. I think it's just a time to really become witnesses to Christ in charity and love to all these women that are maybe not understanding. And this is also a great opportunity of evangelization to teach women and men about the sacredness of life.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Losing no time after last Friday's court decision in the Dobbs case, Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch certified the state's 2007 trigger law on Monday with the intention that it would go into effect 10 days later. It bans all abortions except in cases of rape or when the mother's life is in danger. But abortion providers have already filed suit against Mississippi as well as other states with trigger bans. Catholic News Agency is tracking the trigger laws, lawsuits filed against them, and where those bans are being blocked. Visit their website for an interactive map. We spoke this week to the Mississippi team that led the fight to overturn Roe and Casey in the Dobbs versus Jackson case. Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch is the first woman to serve in that role. She appointed former Supreme Court Clerk Scott Stewart as Mississippi Solicitor General in 2021. He delivered oral argument before the High Court in the Dobbs case. They're both on the record. Thank you both for joining us for this important discussion on this historic moment for our country and for the life movement. General Lynn Fitch, how did you feel after the decision came down? Was the win upholding the law something you expected?
Well, it was an incredible time, certainly a moment in history for all of us, for the pro-life movement. What an amazing time to overturn Roe v. Wade and to move forward and talk about empowering women and promoting life at the same time. So truly an amazing, outstanding time for all of us, and the excitement that we have moving forward for all women.
Solicitor General Scott, you argued the case. Did you feel vindicated in your team's choice, not only to ask for the court to uphold your 15-week abortion ban, but also to go the whole way and overturn Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey?
Thank you, Monse. I think we felt great about the result. It really couldn't have been better. It's everything we asked for, that we fought hard for, that we did our best to present to the court. I think something that was very vindicating for us, in addition to the result and the fantastic quality of the court's opinion, is just, you know, from the start of this case, when the court took it, Mississippi approached with General Fitch leading, we approached this a certain way. She asked people to think about this a different way, think about the whole picture, think about the importance of these laws, the importance of people deciding these hard questions of life, of health, of families, and not having that wholly in the judicial, within the judicial ken. And it's very gratifying, tremendous honor to see the court fully deliver on that, and just that approach of saying, hey, you know, here's how we view this, here's the right way, and just kind of with a message of hope and looking toward the future to do a lot of good work. That was just incredibly just really marvelous to behold. It's, you know, my job, I joke, my job is to put things into words, and I still haven't really found the words to describe the court's decision. So it was very vindicating and honoring.
And you were following Attorney General's Fitch's very beautiful understanding of what women actually need in society, and you brought it up in oral argument. You're a former Supreme Court clerk. Your understanding of the court is very different, and as you were standing before them, you were discussing the consequences that this decision has had in your discussion of overturning Roe and Casey. Do you think that made a difference?
I think the court's opinion really shows that they understand how damaging Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey have been. They've divided us on a national scale, on a person-to-person local level. They've made it very hard for people to find solutions on this issue. They've warped the way we think about the abortion issue, about legal questions, about the court, about the law. About working toward, in debate, in a constructive democratic process to good solutions. And I think the court really drew out, hey, look at all of these harms from this decision. So I was very glad that resonated well. I know how careful the court is to overrule precedent. It's something it considers very carefully. And I think the court really did appreciate and do a tremendous job of articulating all the harms that had stemmed from Roe and Casey.
All the harms is real. Attorney General Fitch, why a 15-week ban? I think that's the question on everyone's hearts. Is there some consensus there for the people of Mississippi, or would you have chosen a different limit?
Well, certainly we are there to uphold the laws and the Constitution of the state of Mississippi, and that was what was passed by our legislature. So that was our charge to uphold that. But as Solicitor General Stewart said, you know, we looked at it from a holistic perspective. We asked the court to overturn this egregious behavior that had gone on for 50 years in this special set of laws by unelected justices and return it to the states, because this is such an important issue that everyone should have a voice, should have the opinions relayed through their legislators.
Solicitor General Scott, do you expect additional lawsuits now that the trigger law has been certified and with this decision in hand?
I think we'll sort of wait and see what happens. I think, one, we benefit from a tremendously powerful, clear, and just really just couldn't get any better opinion that will provide tremendous guidance and a lot of clarity on this issue. I think something that'll be very important, I think, that General Fitch just alluded to is the need to lead, to persuade, to capitalize on the fact that we now have this issue in the democratic process. And to really follow through on the effort that General Fitch has spearheaded over the last year plus of just saying, hey, think about this a different way. Look at the whole situation. Look at children. Look at women. Look at families. Look at how we as a society are addressing these very hard, challenging, difficult moments. And I think it's something that it was never just about prevailing in this case, but it's about making people really understand, hey, this is a hard issue for us as a society. Let's get together to find solutions. Because we haven't been able to do that for a long time. So I think we're just very grateful that is now an opportunity. And I think it'll be a real chance for people across the country, whatever station or position they are, to really lead and just address this issue very constructively.
General Fitch, let's talk about those solutions. You have been spearheading all kinds of movements around the importance of empowering women by highlighting the plight of single mothers, the pay gap between men and women, child support laws, foster care and adoption. Where will you start?
Oh, well, we're going to comprehensively move forward. It's certainly a unified front to do that. We were very excited that equal pay passed in the last legislative session. Again, that sends a strong statement to women across our state that they are valued, that they are a tremendous part of the tapestry of the state of Mississippi, and they will be continuing to be a part of the workforce, education, and all that they will do in their respective lives. So, yes, we are working right now on a comprehensive legislative package, as well as some policies and programs that we can work together with our public and our private partners, our agencies, to move forward, because we are going to move forward with actual steps, driving toward those solutions, finding the ways that we can empower those women and those children. And we can do that those many different directions you just talked about. But certainly as we talk about childcare, you know, how do we make that affordable and quality for women? We need to talk about enforcement of the support for child support for these women, because for far too long, they have borne the brunt and the majority of the financial and hardships of these children from a financial perspective. We'll definitely be talking about innovative ways to talk about workplace flexibility, make those environments better, talk about maternity and paternity leave. And certainly we're going to need to talk about streamlining the adoption process and taking a hard look at our foster care system, because we have these precious children and we need to be connecting them with the families who are ready to love them and to help them thrive.
That's very true. General Fitch, this is personal for you. This is something that you've been working on for a long time and that you've, as you mentioned, been praying for a long time. What is the actual solution that you see moving forward? Going back to the democratic process, do you see this country as a pluralistic society where everyone makes that choice for themselves?
You know, certainly every state will be different. Every state will act differently, may have different laws, different programs. But we're going to look at how you truly empower women. It's the first time we've been able to have a comprehensive view at that. And we'll be moving to take actions to make that happen on all levels.
And seeing the law as a deterrent, there was a beautiful piece in the Washington Post that described the life of a young woman who said that she would have missed out on her twins had abortion not been illegal in Texas. Are there other deterrents that people should be looking at, like heavier punishment for incest, rape, or domestic violence? I know that's an issue that you care about a lot.
Well, certainly there are so many vulnerable individuals and so many victims, and how we can step in and help them is so important. You know, for so long, they felt like they didn't have that safety network. And so this gives us the opportunity to really do a hard look at how we can provide all those resources and tools so that they are able to move forward after they've been through some very horrific times. You know, but the end game is always to support these women, to support the children, and to help them really thrive in their lives.
Do you feel a call to be a voice for other people who may not know how to do what you're doing in their state?
You know, absolutely. I want to be a mentor and play any role that I can to others, because again, it's so significant. We are at the cusp of this historic time. And for the first time, we can have a healthy dialogue about what do we truly do that empowers women? How do we make that happen? And again, we can't just keep talking about it. We have to now provide sustainable action items that really take care of these women and their children. So I am ready to help anyone and to be there providing support any way that I possibly can.
And Scott, do you feel the same way? Do you feel like you're called in this moment to share with other advocates how to have the courage to go all the way, especially on these issues that affect human life and human rights?
A great thing about this case is when you stand for the right thing and do it in the right way, you can make wonderful things happen in the world. And we've done our very best to do that. I know we've both been tremendously honored to do that. And to the extent that anyone can see and appreciate that approach and get something out of it and deal with, you know, whatever the issues are that are important to them, I think that's just a tremendous honor and tremendously gratifying that to just kind of spread that way of doing things and have a really positive impact throughout a broad range of issues in our country.
Well, there's a long battle ahead, both for helping women and helping families, and also for helping other states understand what they can do to follow in your footsteps. Thank you both for your leadership and for your courage.
Thank you.
Beyond the immediate discussion of the impact of Dobbs are related issues in the now complicated legal scenario coursing through the state courts and legislatures. To discuss that, we're joined by Heather Hacker. She's the former Texas Assistant Solicitor General who now leads her own firm, focusing on defending pro-life laws and handling high-stakes trial litigation. Heather, it's great to have you back on the show. Photos of women posing in handcuffs were all over social media. Is the criminalization of women, now that there's no federal right to abortion, really a threat to victims of abortion?
No, I don't think so. And exactly as you just said, women are victims of abortion, and state laws should make that abundantly clear. And in fact, most state laws already do. They either explicitly exclude women from prosecution, or they're written in a way that they would not apply to women receiving abortions.
And I know that's something that the Catholic bishops made clear, that they're very much in favor of protecting women and helping women. But a recent lawsuit was filed after Governor DeSantis's signed Florida's 15-week ban on abortion. And this is another take on religion. There is a group of Cosmic Jews that are claiming it violates the religious freedom of the way that they practice Judaism because it doesn't allow them to have abortions. Does this challenge have any legs?
I don't think so, unless there were a court that were inclined to agree that someone's religious beliefs would entitle them to violate the law or commit crimes. I don't think you could say that someone's religious beliefs justify committing murder. So I don't think that lawsuit will be successful.
And the idea of cosmic Judaism doesn't necessarily have consistency to it. You would say that someone has to actually be changed by their religious beliefs. So the consistency here matters, too, when the court is considering whether you're sincere or not. Isn't that right?
Yes, that definitely does matter. The courts don't do a deep dive into people's religious beliefs. You generally don't want courts deciding whether or not someone's religious beliefs are sincere, but they do. That is part of the reason the plaintiff has to establish that they have a sincere religious belief.
So then what about the opposite situation in so-called sanctuary states where abortion will be protected through the third trimester, and in some places like Oregon where funds have been created to subsidize the procedure? What can pro-life Catholics do in those states?
So there are a lot of pro-life activists that have said for a while that we need to make abortion illegal and unthinkable. And I think that second part of it is what people should focus on. Working on the making abortion unthinkable part, continuing to educate people about the truth about abortion, and committing to caring for women and their families facing difficult situations in tangible ways so that no woman feels forced to have an abortion because of her circumstances. And they can work through political channels to do that. And the beauty of the Dobbs decision is that's exactly what it does, is it gives this ability to convince others and to change things politically back to the people.
One of the discussions that came up in the decision is this abortion across state lines. Can the criminalization of abortion, I have an abortion in California and then I go home to Mississippi, can it be criminalized?
So if you look at the Dobbs decision, Justice Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion, and he specifically states in that opinion that he does not think that such laws would pass constitutional muster. I believe he said that he thought they would violate the interstate right to travel. Mm-hmm. And so without Justice Kavanaugh as part of that, I don't think you would have a Supreme Court majority that would uphold a law relating to that.
So maybe that's a deterrent for people who are thinking that's an avenue. But then what about medical abortions, which also have similar discussions around them? You can have pills that are illegal in one state mailed to another state. From a pro-life perspective, is the best option to regulate those abortion pills since the federal government lowered the supervision requirements for the drugs during COVID?
Yes, states can regulate abortion. They can regulate abortion pills. And I would also note that it is illegal under federal law to mail abortion agents.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that, and I'm sure our viewers didn't either. So that's a good thing to know. And then let's go to other types of pills like contraception. Is it a rumor that Americans in this country, women specifically, are going to lose access to contraception?
So there are people saying that. There's a lot of misinformation going around, and it's a lot of fear-mongering. I think that's very unlikely. And I think that the majority opinion in Dobbs went out of its way to make very clear that the opinion did not apply to any of the other rights that were established under the Substantive Due Process Clause. The only person that raised any questions as to that was Justice Thomas in his concurring opinion. And it was on the basis that he thinks that for the same reasons that the court rejected the right to abortion under the Constitution, under the Substantive Due Process Clause, he thinks that the rest of the court's substantive due process jurisprudence is equally flawed and wants the court to revisit it. But no one else joined that opinion. So I think it probably is unlikely that a majority of the court would want to revisit any of those decisions.
And abortion really is an animal unto itself in the way that it was decided and how it's proliferated its effects across the law. One last thing on the pro-life side. Is there any way that this decision sets up a potential path for legal protection for life in the womb, a right to life found in the Constitution?
So again, I don't think so. The Dobbs decision was great for many reasons, but I don't think it goes that far. Justice Kavanaugh, in his concurring opinion, notes that he thinks that the Constitution is neutral on abortion. So I'm not sure that he would go so far as to hold that the Constitution establishes fetal personhood, but I could be wrong.
Well, that's you're saying the neutrality, which is something that we heard in oral argument with Solicitor General Scott Stewart. I know that it's something that a lot of people are thinking about. So everything going back to the states gives you even more work, and we look forward to tracking it. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
In the changing landscape of life after Roe, women are sharing their experiences with abortion, from the impact on minorities to what made them become pro-life. Two leading advocates for strong family policies have a lot to say about what comes next. They'll join us when EWTN News In Depth returns.
Roe versus Wade is overruled. Roe versus Wade is overturned.
The Supreme Court decision on abortion is striking an emotional chord for many who have fought and prayed for years for this moment, like Christina Bennett, a leading advocate for life in the Black community. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. We continue our coverage of this new pro-life era in America with those who have been leading the grassroots efforts to support mothers in need. Christina joins us now from Connecticut, along with Leah Labresco Sargent, a writer, author, and speaker on pro-life issues, featured in the New York Times just this week. Thank you both for joining us. Christina, the immediate response to those pushing for a right to abortion was to bemoan the impact the Supreme Court decision would have on minority women. How will this decision really impact them?
Well, I think it will give us an opportunity for life, an opportunity to preserve the lives of our families. We've been targeted by the abortion industry since the beginning of Planned Parenthood. They're rooted in eugenics and population control, and Margaret Sanger had her Negro Project. So since the beginning of their work, they've put their abortion clinics in our neighborhood and they've targeted us. And now, thanks to the Supreme Court, we have an opportunity for states to protect the lives of our children in our community. I think it'll cause the Black community to flourish and to grow.
Leah, hearing Christina and everything that she's saying, did that have anything to do with why you moved from being pro-abortion to being pro-life?
I think the thing a lot of people can acknowledge, even people who push for abortion access, is that it's not a pro-choice society when a lot of mothers feel that only one choice, abortion, is open to them. And our challenge is that taking abortion off the table shouldn't lead to a narrower life or a more constrained life, but a flourishing life where people feel that violence is no longer demanded of them as the entry price to succeed in society.
Well, we're definitely going to lean into that. But before that, Christina, you had comments on religious leadership that were very important, or rather the lack of it. After the decision, you pointed to some leaders who weren't talking about the impact that this decision could have. What do you think religious leadership should be doing now that the abortion question is up to the states?
I think they should be speaking biblical truth. And the Bible shows us that God is the author and the creator of life. He tells us, you know, choose life that you and your descendants may live. And I know that doesn't directly talk about abortion, but as you read the scriptures, it's clear that you see that God cares about the life of the vulnerable, the weak, those that are appointed to die, and he fights for them, as well as widows and orphans and mothers. And he wants them to flourish and to live. And so I think leaders need to be bold and speak the truth, even if it offends your congregations, even if it causes people to walk out, even if it causes people to perhaps not give tithe money to the church. It's worth it, because when we speak truth as religious leaders, we are saving lives. And there's also women in our congregations who had abortions, and they're hurt, and they need to know that there's healing and forgiveness. And so it's so important for us to be bold and to speak truth, regardless of the cost.
Leah, you're listening to this from Christina about religious leadership, but I know that you also emphasize secular leadership and that the abortion really is the price of admission that society demands of women, like you just said. Making abortion illegal is one step people can pursue, but you've said it isn't enough. How can our culture make more room for the vulnerable babies and their mothers?
I think the first step is always providing, you know, clear material support. Parents don't have access to parental leave. An astounding proportion of Americans don't have $200 on hand for an emergency, and a baby is full of emergencies. So direct material support to parents is where we start. But you know, you're right that this is also a specifically religious problem, because it's not just material support that people need. It's hope in the darkest of times, hope that God has a special plan and a particular love for each individual, no matter how hard the circumstances of their birth.
And you were challenged a little bit this week by the person who was leading your New York Times commentary, saying, well, you're saying that women need more opportunities. How are you going to give them that when you're not letting them have abortions?
You know, I think the issue is there's a lot of things that could technically give us more opportunities, you know, by saying no to someone else's life, a parent walking away from their children after birth, a husband and wife, you know, walking away from each other just to play the field, you know, see what everything else could be. But our goal isn't to have every single option open to us. It's to have the option to do the right thing, to be supported in our duties to others. And I think too many vulnerable mothers who want to get to meet their children feel like there's no support for that choice for them.
And a big lack of accompaniment. Christina, what would you add about what we can commit to reduce or remove the pressures that lead women to consider ending the lives of their children?
I think we have to be involved in our community. I think it's very important for us to support pregnancy resource centers. They're under attack right now. Their buildings are being attacked, graffitied, firebombed. It's important for us to know where they're at. So when pregnant women call us or contact us, we can take them there for an appointment, or we can take them to our local church or our community organizations. Do you know where to go if a pregnant woman contacts you and she needs housing, or she's in a domestic violence situation and she needs to get out of it, or she needs to find affordable health care, or she needs to find a good job? Do you know the numbers to call? Do you know the resources in your city or state that you can help her? It's important for us to be knowledgeable about these things.
And for us to be engaged. Leah, leaning into the conversation about pregnancy centers, you talked about misinformation about the role pregnancy centers play and access to important life-saving treatments for women. It's all over social media. The confusion is very real. How are you countering this?
I think one of the best ways is to know a specific pregnancy center that you volunteer at, or you know someone else who volunteers at that you can speak to in detail. Because it's a big country. There aren't zero pregnancy centers that ever make a mistake or do something bad, but being able to point to, here's the one I know, here's how I know what they do, here's concretely what I've seen them do, is a better way to answer than to answer in the aggregate.
Christina, last question for you then about adoption. Minority women believe that abortion keeps their rights in place, and they don't realize that they have other options. You've talked about adoption as one of the things that most people don't discuss. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, unfortunately, there is a stigma with adoption. And I know when I used to work for a pregnancy center, I met many young women who were so afraid of adoption that in their mind, abortion was a better option than adoption. But we have to just educate people and let them know that there's different ways that you can adopt. My husband and I, we adopted through the foster care system at the beginning of the pandemic, through a foster to adopt program in Connecticut. There's also different agencies that you can adopt through, open adoption, closed adoption. So it's getting rid of the stigmas and helping people understand that this is an option. Of course, it's not going to be an option for every person, and it is not without complications and trauma and pain, because those are all real parts of adoption. It's not a quick fix, but it is a way for a child to be brought into a loving family. And so I would encourage all families, especially those that are pro-life, to look into this and to see if you have room to do this, whether it's something like foster care or whether it's something like fully taking in a child to your house through adoption.
Well, we definitely have much work to do. Thank you both. And we'll be watching what you're saying.
God bless.
We move on from the Dobbs case and abortion to other major news this week from the Supreme Court.
And that I will faithfully and impartially
discharge and perform
all the duties incumbent upon me
Justice Stephen Breyer ends 30 years at the High Court as he gives the judicial oath of office to the justice who replaces him.
The hard part's over. We won, and I'm happy. I can't stop smiling.
And we hear from the high school football coach at the pivot point of a ruling about prayer in public schools.
I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
At noon on Thursday, Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement made way for Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson as she took both the constitutional oath from Chief Justice John Roberts and the judicial oath from the justice she clerked for many years ago. The 51-year-old Jackson becomes the 116th justice to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court and the very first black female justice in our nation's 233-year history. While she does not change the balance of the majority conservative court, she will bring a fresh perspective as she joins two other women justices in the liberal minority. Justice Jackson's swearing in came on the last day of a monumental term in which more impactful decisions were announced. The court issued a ruling limiting the Environmental Protection Agency's power to regulate carbon emissions from existing power plants. The court found the Clean Air Act did not grant the EPA authority to make its own regulatory scheme to cap carbon dioxide emissions. In the 6-3 decision, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in the majority opinion that regulatory decisions and consequences rest with Congress. Justice Kagan, in her dissent, wrote that the court was stripping the EPA of the power that Congress gave it to curb greenhouse gases. Some climate experts warn the move allows a free-for-all environment for oil and gas companies. And justices overturned the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers, which forced thousands to wait south of the border while their claims were adjudicated. The court ruled 5-4 with Chief Justice Roberts writing the opinion and Justice Kavanaugh joining him and the three liberal judges in the majority. The court's decision comes as the flow of migrants to the southwest border continues to strain law enforcement and humanitarian resources. And of course, earlier this week, another victory for religious liberty as the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a high school football coach's freedom to pray on the field. Coach Joseph Kennedy said he was fired after praying on the 50-yard line after games. It's a practice he did often. Sometimes his students or players from opposing teams would join him. The district said it was trying to avoid the appearance that it was endorsing a religion. Justices ruled 6-3 that the school district breached Kennedy's free exercise and free speech rights. The decision was not welcomed by everyone.
It opens the door to much more coercive prayer in our public schools. But that's not it. As we've seen from the past few days, when church-state separation is undermined and when religious extremist agenda is advanced, our hard-won equality and freedom disappears.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, wrote that the decision, quote, sets us further down a perilous path in forcing states to entangle themselves with religion. Justices in the majority, however, said that the prayers occurred after games ended, when students were free to do other things, and the coach was not responsible for them. We spoke with Joseph Kennedy and one of his attorneys, Jeremy Dyes.
Today, because of Coach Kennedy, I think our coaches and teachers who are men and women of faith in this country have cause for rejoicing that their religious liberty has been protected on campus.
It is so amazing to see how many people were standing up with me and were alongside me in this fight. And it's just those constant reminders that there's just millions of people in America that really believe in the Constitution and the First Amendment is alive and well.
And the man who argued the case in front of the Supreme Court, Paul Clement, former Solicitor General of the United States, joins us now to share his insights on this big win. Paul, what does the Kennedy decision say about the importance of a diversity of voices in American society?
Well, Monty, it's great to be with you. And the Kennedy decision makes clear that among the diversity of voices that people can hear in the public square, that religious voices and prayer can be part of that discussion. And school districts and governments do not need to bend over backwards to try to limit the voices, the secular voices, but can extend the kind of full range of voices to people who who want to speak from a religious viewpoint or want to engage in prayer.
That's right. In America, we have freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. Why was it so important to protect this coach's personal prayer in a public space?
It was so important because it was so important to Coach Kennedy. I mean, this, you know, Coach Kennedy is really the hero in this case because he was willing to stand on principle. He was willing to fight all the way to the Supreme Court in order to engage in a religious practice that he felt compelled to engage in. This is, you know, this is, I think, sometimes hard for people who approach these issues from a more secular standpoint to understand. But when somebody like Coach Kennedy decides that it's important to his religious life and his prayer life to engage in a brief prayer of thanks after the football game, it's not optional for him. He feels called to do it. And so he was forced to choose between continuing in his job and following that call. And I think in order to vindicate his rights to follow that call, that was why this is just such an important case for religious liberty.
And in vindicating those rights, the court had to do something really important. This term, the Supreme Court clarified that allowing religion in the public square doesn't mean that the government is endorsing or establishing a religion. Can you explain that to us?
I'll try. It's super important because the reason that these cases with, you know, student speech or teacher prayer or coach prayer keep coming up is that traditionally schools and other government offices have felt like they're caught between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. They feel like if they deny somebody their right to engage in religious exercise, they might get sued. But if they allow it, they'll be sued by the ACLU or Citizens United, or, you know, for separation of church and state because they've endorsed religion or they violated the Establishment Clause. And what's so important about the Kennedy decision is the Supreme Court has made even more clear than it ever has before that school districts don't have to fear liability if they simply allow private religious speech to take place on the school grounds. To paraphrase the court, the school doesn't endorse everything that it fails to censor. It can allow Coach Kennedy to engage in his own personal private prayer, and that doesn't become the school's own prayer.
That's right. They don't have to own everything that people say. Otherwise, we'd be in really big trouble in this country. Well, let's talk about the other cases that you argued before the court. I think people forget that you're a known quantity at the Supreme Court, and you argued four cases this term, one of which that you won on concealed carry here out of New York. And the same day, your law firm gave you the impossible choice of choosing between your job and your clients. Tell us what happened.
Well, thank you, Monsi. I mean, obviously, the Supreme Court decision was a big win for my clients, who included two individual New Yorkers who had their constitutional rights vindicated by the Supreme Court 6-3. As you indicated, the law firm then essentially gave me, as you say, an impossible choice to either drop those clients, including the clients that had just won in the Supreme Court, or leave the law firm. And although in some respects it was an impossible choice, in other respects it was just a very straightforward choice. Because for a lawyer, your relationship with your clients is a special relationship. It is a real calling, in a sense, professionally, to represent those individuals and carry through the representation till the end. You have a lot of choices as a lawyer as to which cases you take. But once you take a case, your obligation is to follow it through to the end unless the client has reach their duties to you. So I really felt in the end the choice before me was a clear one. And so my partner Aaron Murphy and I stuck with our clients and have left the firm.
Let's wrap up the Supreme Court term this year. What was the main message from the Supreme Court on religion and religious liberty?
Well, the main message is that religious liberty is protected very robustly in our Constitution. Our Constitution isn't neutral on the question of religious liberty. It's very protective of religious liberty. And you saw that both in terms of kind of free exercise cases, but also in terms of what the court said in the Kennedy case about the Establishment Clause. For a long time, the court had applied a test, the so-called Lemon Test, that was really very begrudging in terms of religious liberty and made it very easy for the government to be accused of violating the Establishment Clause. And the court, by a 6-3 majority, made clear that that really has no role to play, and the Constitution and its religion clauses work together to protect religious liberty.
That's right. Religion has a special place in American society, and we are allowed to be first-class citizens and to bring it with us wherever we go, rather than pretending to be second-class citizens because we believe in one God. This is a historic term and one that we'll be looking forward to talking to you about in the future as things unfold next Supreme Court term. Thank you so much, Paul.
Great to be with you.
So the plight of migrants seeking refuge is always a humanitarian crisis, but tonight we are dealing with a horrific human tragedy.
Next, the Week in Review, including news from Texas as the death toll increases after dozens of migrants are found packed into a tractor trailer in a smuggling attempt gone horribly wrong. An assault on the innocent as the Russians bomb a Ukrainian shopping mall. And then a welcome respite. Beautiful images from the Vatican at the Mass for the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul. EWTN News In Depth will be right back.
News about strength in unity tops the Week in Review. The North American Treaty Organization, or NATO, experienced its largest expansion in decades this week. During a three-day summit in Madrid, leaders from member nations formally invited Sweden and Finland to join NATO, giving the Western Military Alliance a new 800-mile border with Russia. NATO also announced plans to increase its rapid reaction force by next year in Eastern Europe, where countries from Romania to the Baltics worry about Russia's future intentions. President Joe Biden said that expansion would include a new permanent U.S. base in Poland. And the leaders condemned what they called Russia's appalling cruelty in Ukraine and declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to its members' peace and security. In Ukraine, the country is still reeling from a Russian attack clearly targeting civilians when a cruise missile hit a crowded shopping mall hundreds of miles from the front lines. The missile ignited a huge fire that burned through the building within minutes, trapping many inside, so hot it melted glass and metal. Hundreds of people were in the mall during the time of impact. Nearly 20 people are confirmed dead and 20 more are missing. Dozens are in intensive care. Rescue crews frantically search for survivors, but the explosion was so powerful, some remains may never be found. Psychologists are working at the scene to help families come to terms with that.
I am a crisis psychologist. I've been working for 20 years, but this is my first experience of the kind. Before, we had crisis situations connected with nature, road traffic collisions, but this was the first such situation. Throughout these long days, all of us are feeling this kind of shock, confusion, and anger.
The mall site is now a scene of a growing memorial. As residents survey the wreckage, some family members still hope for news of their loved ones. This week, the largest prisoner exchange of war occurred between the Ukrainians and Russians. An equal number of soldiers, reportedly 144 from each side, were returned home. These images show Ukrainians arriving by bus. Most are recuperating from serious injuries, gunshot wounds, burns, broken bones, and amputations. Included in this group are 95 soldiers who bravely fought until the end at the steel plant in Mariupol before it fell to the Russians. A horrific scene on the outskirts of San Antonio, Texas, in what is being called the deadliest human smuggling case in U.S. history. Dozens of migrants arriving illegally in the United States were found dead on Monday in an abandoned tractor trailer. 60 migrants were crammed inside the sweltering heat. The victims, of all ages, were from Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras. At the time we record this program, the death toll is 53, with several others still hospitalized for heat stroke and exhaustion. This week, the community in San Antonio honored the dead with a memorial and prayed for those victims still recovering. The mayor called for justice to be done, and the head of Catholic Charities in San Antonio called for mercy for other migrants seeking shelter in America.
They don't have a choice. They don't have a life, and they don't feel safe. They're hungry. So for them, America is not a choice. It's the only option they have.
We hope that those responsible for putting these people in such humane conditions are prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Federal investigators arrested four men in relation to the incident: the truck driver who pretended to be one of the immigrants, a conspirator who spoke over the phone with the driver about the smuggling, and two Mexican citizens who were found at a residence tied to the truck's registration. The investigation and the long process of finding and identifying all the victims is ongoing. The FBI has opened an investigation into sex abuse in the New Orleans Archdiocese going back decades. In a rare federal look into clergy abuse, agents are investigating whether priests in the archdiocese took children across state lines to molest them and whether those accused can be prosecuted under an anti-sex trafficking law. More than a dozen alleged abuse victims have been interviewed. Some cases under review allege abuse during trips to Mississippi camps or amusement parks in Texas and Florida. The archdiocese is already reeling from bankruptcy brought on by previous lawsuits claiming church leaders turned a blind eye to abuse. An American hero, Woody Williams, the last surviving World War II recipient of the Medal of Honor, has died at the age of 98. During the now historic Battle of Iwo Jima, Williams fought for 4 hours to help save other Marines who were pinned down, using a flamethrower to fend off the Japanese. President Harry Truman presented him with the Medal of Honor in 1945. Williams served in the Marine Corps and Marine Corps Reserves for 20 years, and then went on to the Department of Veterans Affairs, where he worked for decades as an advocate for Gold Star families. He died Wednesday in West Virginia at the Herschel Woody Williams VA Medical Center, named in his honor. EWTN News in Depth will be back in a moment with our Images of the Week. All set. Okay. What can you do to participate in the church's work with passion and humility? And what can we do together to make the world more humane and just? Those were the questions Pope Francis asked in his homily on Wednesday during the Mass celebrating the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul. The Pope also prayed at St. Peter's Basilica with a delegation from the Orthodox Patriarchy of Constantinople. Scenes from the Mass are our Images of the Week, accompanied by music sung by an Orthodox choir from the country of Georgia. That's our program for today. Next week, we take an in-depth look at the National Eucharistic Revival. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope you'll join us for that special episode, same time next week. See you then.